طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and continued in his memory by a group of his colleagues. Good morning. This is John Roberts. This morning we will be talking about water. Water, or the lack thereof, in Palestine. The water in Palestine is completely controlled by Israel, even though some of the major aquifers are on Palestinian land. Even from the Palestinian aquifers, Israel uses 85% of the water, leaving just 15% for Palestinian use. This issue took a very personal turn for us this summer. Our co-host, Samer Jaber, who lives in a village near Bethlehem in the West Bank, informed us this past summer that his family had not received any water for a 28-day period. Imagine that. Living without water in your home for a month. We're going to speak live with Samer from his home in the West Bank in a few moments to learn firsthand what it is like to live without a source of water in your home. But first, here is an overview of the water crisis in Palestine, Israel. There is enough water to go around in the occupied Palestinian territory. But discriminatory laws mean that many Palestinians are left with a trickle, while Israelis who control the pipelines use enormous quantities of water. As an occupying power, the Israeli government is responsible under international humanitarian law for the well-being of Palestinians, including ensuring that they have adequate water supply. Even though it controls all sources of fresh water in the West Bank, most of which, as we have said, is in aquifers under Palestinian territory, the Israeli government has neglected this obligation. Some Palestinian communities live with as little as 20 liters, 5.3 gallons, of water per person per day. This is barely enough water for their basic needs. Taps often run dry for several weeks during the summer in Palestinian cities like Bethlehem. Residents are then forced to buy expensive water from private vendors, paying as much as four times the amount of money for that water as the Israelis pay. Some communities depend on rainwater collection cisterns, often paid for with international aid, for their water. In 2011, the Israeli army destroyed an average of almost three cisterns a month, and since then the rate of these demolitions has been increasing. It is not unusual for the Israeli military to come into a village and shoot bullets into the water storage tanks on the rooftops of Palestinian homes, draining the precious water in a matter of minutes. In contrast, about 500,000 Israelis live in illegal settlements located beside thirsty Palestinian communities. They have unrestricted access to water, well-watered lawns, and even swimming pools. Israeli settlers in settlements built illegally on Palestinian land use as much as 20 times as much water as the most water-deprived Palestinians. The inequities of water use are stark and unjust. To get a better sense of the realities of these injustices, we have Samer Jaber on the phone from Bethlehem to talk to us about the water crisis in Palestine and, in particular, how this has affected his family in their village near Bethlehem. Good morning, Samer.
Good morning, John, and good morning to our listeners.
Samer, few Americans know about or understand what you're going through in terms of the access the Palestinians have to water. Tell us about this water crisis and what you and your family experience in terms of access to water in your home.
You know, John, I was living in Boston over the last few years, and I have come back a year ago. And from the first minute I have arrived, I faced this critical problem, that I find my house have a problem of deep shortage of water. So this was in last May. So since last May, I find that we have to collect water in tanks above the rooftops. So this matter continued in the last summer. So from May that time until October, we received one times water every 28 days on average. Sometimes we receive this water in 26 days, sometimes after 30 days. So on average was like 28 days. And the amount we receive is specified to the capacity of our tanks at the house. At the same time, this summer, the same critical problem took place, that we did not receive water that much, and we received one time every 28 days on average. So what I did, I calculated how much water we receive on average, and we store in these tanks, and we, I find that we receive on average almost 14,000 liters every 28 days. And in my house, we live there 13 individuals. So if we just make a simple calculation, I find that we consume around 38 liters per person per day. This amount is less than World Health Organization decided for a person that should be at least 100 liters a day. So we consume almost one-third of what support an average person receives at my house. I'm talking about my house during summer. So this is really what we face. And in order to overcome this problem, actually, people try to dig some cisterns and have some wells. But even though they continue to control the amount of water, since all of the water reservoirs in the occupied Palestinian territories in the West Bank and even part of the water in Gaza is controlled by Israel. So this is the situation, John, and I don't think any either European and North American can live under these conditions. Yes, John.
No, we're going to talk about that in the next segment, when what happens when Americans try to live on that little bit of water. But tell me, you say that the you try to collect water, but in the summer, the rainfall must be very, very minimal, and so I imagine the collection is minimal, and you get water about every 28 days. But what happens when you absolutely run dry before the 28 days? Is there any way you can get emergency access to water, or even buying water? Is that even possible?
Actually, yeah, it is possible, but even the, this water is controlled by Israel. So usually if we run out of water, what we do is we call some of the contractors who have a water port in one of the next to the Israeli settlements, or have relation with one of the settlers, so he can just take this water. So what the issue that we have to pay at least fourfold the average water price. we have to pay a lot of money just to receive small amount of water. So we usually order, for example, 15 cubic liter of water, and we have to wait a few days until we receive this water. So we have to put a very constrained schedule at my house for how to use this kind of water. For example, we have to just shower one time a week, and this water that we use, we collect it also to use it for bathrooms, you know. So we have sometimes to use water more than one time in order just to restrict ourselves specific amount of water. For example, this very tedious and very very difficult when you are talking about kids who are less than 15 years old, or some of my nephews, for example, are less than 5 years old, and they really suffer out of this water shortage. So yeah, we can receive water, but this water is very expensive and it's not safe, because you know, we bring water through tanks, and when you move water from one place to the other, there is a high possibility to contaminate this water. So we need also to like use specific kind of filters to filtrate this water, and to boil sometimes this water to be sure that it's not contaminated. So it's very long process, very tedious, and sometimes deleterious. So we have to always keep in mind that it's not easy to live under the occupation of water. It's not just occupation of land, it's occupation of meat land, occupation of water.
I know in communicating last summer, you talked about how difficult it was for you to speak with your nephew, who was wondering why he can't take a shower, why he can't bathe, more than once a week or so. How do you deal with the issue of, in a household with a number of people, the issue of bathing, which you know, it takes quite a bit of water.
You know, John, part of my family land is next to an Israeli settlement, legal settlement. And sometimes my nephews and I go there to our land, and we see that settlers have swimming pools. And one of my nephews, as I have told you, asked me why they have swimming pools while we should just take showers one time a week. So I have no rational explanation for him except that there is occupation, and the occupation control everything. And it's rational for me, but it's not acceptable for this child, because he see other child. He do not care if he's Israeli or Palestinian, but also enjoy water as much as he can, because the Israeli can... An average Israeli in the settlements use something around 350 liters a day, while my house use around 40 liters a day per person. So it's irrational for my nephew to understand this. And actually, we have just to put things in order to use a specific amount of water per day. We could not consume water freely, and we could not just enjoy water as much as a settler used to do.
And as far as cooking is concerned, both cooking and then having to, you know, to clean up afterwards, you talked about having to use water sometimes, two or three times, how you need to save water. And how does that work? Is it you would use water from cooking and save it and then use it for washing dishes? Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about?
Yeah, you know, sometimes I'll give you just another example. For example, we use water for cooking, and this water sometimes we have to buy it in a bottle, like buying specific amount of water in bottles, and this is very expensive water. And for the other use, we use water that we store in tanks, and this water, for example, for cleaning dishes, we use it, but we do not throw it away. We use this water again, for example, to bathroom. So we can use it another time for bathrooms, or we can use it also to water some house plants. So we have to use water more than once, the same amount of water. Like, we have to clean dishes, and after cleaning dishes, we collect this water, came out of cleaning dishes, for other domestic uses, which is very difficult because not easy, always easy, you know. So, and I think my family felt like an average family can have a good source of water because we use filters, but you can imagine other poor families who do not have filters and have specific minimum income, that if they want to use water, boiling this water for use it, so they have to use fuel, and the price of fuel is very expensive in the occupied Palestinian territories, which also add another difficulty to average Palestinian family. So this matter is very difficult because actually we, like, people are in general poor but have to pay more than average to receive very specific water. And as you know, water is a human right issue. People should have access to this water. And this water actually comes from reservoirs and occupied Palestinian territories, actually from the Bethlehem area. So it's Bethlehem water, but we could not use it. We have to use it through the Israelis. During the summer, actually, my village protested in the streets because they did not receive water as others. So the protest was against the Palestinian Authority, who is supposed to administer this area, but actually even Palestinian Authority received water through Israel. So the Palestinian Authority just distributes water but do not control the water resources, which make occupation also very elusive, because Palestinians have direct contact with Palestinian Authority. However, the real control of this water comes from the Israeli side. So you can imagine. I know that Europeans and North Americans find this irrational, but it's the reality under occupation.
Wow. Well, Samer, thank you for sharing this with us. I take it that it's near the end of the summer that the when does the rainy season start? When can you get some relief to fill your cisterns?
We usually receive specific amount of water, and we have like to take all measures because sometimes we receive water during night and sometimes during day, but mostly during night. So we have to wake up the whole night. So and also we have to take measures to clean our system. So it's not an easy way. So it's like you have to monitor the amount of water that you received and the amount of water you already consumed, and also the status of the water tanks and systems.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate having you share your story and the give emphasis to the problems that you face with the water situation in Palestine. That was our co-host, Samer Jaber, speaking to us from Bethlehem concerning the water crisis that his family faced this summer. And we wish his family the best in facing this enormous problem. To give visibility to the American public of the ongoing water crisis in Palestine, the Middle East Children's Alliance, MECCA, developed a nationwide educational campaign called Thirsting for Justice. MECCA works all through the West Bank and Gaza on a variety of projects and has a special water initiative called the Maya Project. The basics of the Thirsting for Justice campaign are that every person who signs up here in the United States is asked to live on 6.3 gallons or 24 quarts of water for 24 hours in solidarity with Palestinian communities under Israeli occupation, who most often live on this amount or less. During the 24 hours, the participant wears a special campaign T-shirt and distributes information to their friends and community about the water crisis and why they are taking part. Then the participant writes or videos about their experiences, and the Thirsting for Justice campaign collects all of these reflections on their blog. Some of us took the challenge, and on August 14th, we lived on 24 quarts of water for 24 hours. That was for drinking, washing, cooking, and use of the toilet, which was the greatest challenge because even the new low-water use toilets, each flush uses 6 quarts of water. That is
1/4
the allotted amount of water for the day. One flush,
1/4 of your water.
Think about it. We had to. We also organized a vigil in Holyoke Center in Harvard Square that day to leaflet pedestrians as they passed by with information about the water crisis in Palestine. Over a dozen folks participated. The highlight was the greeting we got from a Palestinian family from Ramallah, which happened to walk by our demonstration as they were sightseeing in Harvard Square. They were in the United States to bring one of their daughters, who was taking her senior year in a high school in Philadelphia. They could hardly believe that a group of Americans in the middle of summer was calling attention to their plight in Palestine. They were amazed and delighted by our presence. I interviewed two of the participants in the Thirsting for Justice campaign who also were present on the vigil. Here is their take on the campaign.
We're in the heart of Harvard Square at Holyoke Center. There's a group of people here that are taking part in a standout to try to educate people about the water crisis in Palestine. And I have with me one of the participants who was, tell us what you are up to and what you're trying to do here.
Okay, I'm up to...
Your name is?
My name is Eleanor Rothman, and I'm participating in 24 hours of trying to live on 24 liters of water. And that's not very much. It's like 24 bottles of soda for 24 hours. And I'm sure I have, you know, exceeded that already because I've not measured every drop of water I've used. But participating in this has made me so conscious of water and the privileges we assume in this country and many other parts of the world about the availability of water. And the purpose of doing this is to draw attention to the lack of the availability of water in the occupied territories of Palestine.
Now, is it right that the 24 liters relates to the amount of money, amount of water that the Palestinians live on per day?
Yes, it's an average Palestinian lives on that amount of water per day. So think about washing, cleaning, eating, drinking, whatever, cooking, all the different ways that we use water from day to day. And we use much more than 24 liters of water a day. And yet, that is at times the most that people get. There are days on end that people in Palestine do not receive any water at all. And then the water oftentimes comes spoiled because as an occupier, Israel is supposed to maintain the infrastructure of the land that they occupy. And so the aquifers and the sewage systems have all deteriorated, have not been repaired, have not been replaced as needed. And they interfere not only with the distribution of the water, but with the cleanliness of the water and its potability for people to drink and to cook with and to, you know, use for their daily life existence.
What's your response been for your leaflet in here? Have you gotten any response from people?
I'm slightly underwhelmed
with
the level of response.
Yeah.
Some people, first of all, a lot of people are walking by plugged in or talking on their phones, and they're really unavailable for connection. But for those who are, there's some kind of assumptive thing that's going on, that there's a real resistance to taking the leaflet. First of all, many people don't even know what it's about. And then when you explain it, they look at you strangely. I had one person take the leaflet, read it, and give it back to me in a very angry, facial expression. So I think that it's very threatening for people to consider this level of oppression and brutality that continues to be foisted on the Palestinian people by the Israelis, with, of course, the support of our government.
Well, have you ever been to Israel?
Yes, I have, many times.
Many times. So you've seen this firsthand.
I've seen it firsthand. What you will notice when you travel beyond the borders of the 1948 borders, the Green Line as it's called, is that you will pass by settlements that have, very large houses. And in the center, not unlike the gated communities in this country, there'll be a beautiful swimming pool. And then you cross over the border into a Palestinian village. There's obviously no swimming pool. There are obviously not homes as well kept, nor as big. Not that they want those kinds of homes in the first place, but you will also cross over rubble of what used to be a home, or what used to be a cistern, to collect and keep the water for use, that the Israelis have also, in their demolishing of homes, have also demolished the cisterns in which people have kept their water. So you can imagine the Mideast, which is by and large a very arid place, that water is precious for everybody. But what's happening is that the Israelis have controlled the way and the quality of water that comes in to the West Bank as much as the quantity.
Well, thank you very much, and I wish you much luck in the campaign to educate people about the water crisis in Palestine.
Yeah, it's one of many campaigns in which we're trying to educate people about the occupation, the illegal, ongoing 60-year occupation of Palestinian land by the Israelis, which would never be possible without the support of our government. So it's a very sad situation, but, the people in Palestine have resolved. They have what they call samud, which is steadfastness, and they're wonderful role models for us just to keep on that struggle and to keep on doing this, to try and educate people about what's going on, and also visions of possibility.
Much needed.
Much needed, yeah.
Thank you very much, Ellen.
You're quite welcome.
I'm with Skip Scheel, who's a Cambridge photographer and activist who spends several months a year in the West Bank and Gaza, documenting the occupation, and also working specifically on gathering information about the water crisis in the West Bank and Gaza. So, Skip, you spend a lot of time, you've studied the water issue. What needs to be done to get some kind of equity, some kind of just equity in terms of the use of water among Palestinians and Israelis?
Well, to try to answer that, I'd like to bring to our and your listeners' attention a Palestinian hydrologist that I work very closely with. Her name is Fadia Debes Murad, a young woman, internationally acclaimed. Her answer would be, I am done with describing the conditions, the blatant injustice of the water situation. I want to change things. And I believe the most effective way to do that is to bring international law to bear on the situation. And she and I were going to work together. She would outline the argument, and I would find the photographic evidence. About 3 years ago, she went to an international water conference in Turkey. And on her way back, it was during the rainy season, she encountered a storm and slid off the road and was killed. And I feel, like a lot of people who knew her and admired her work, that I am compelled to continue her work, and in particular, her idea of using the international court system. So already there's been adjudication about the wall, which your listeners probably know about. 2005, International Criminal Court said this wall, when built on Palestinian land, is illegal and must be taken down and everybody compensated who suffered as a result of it. And we have yet to see anything like that, with the water issue, but I think that's one way to go.
What seems to be in favor of the Palestinian lawsuit would be the fact that most of the water is from Palestinian land, from the aquifer, the mountain aquifer. Israel controls it, yet the water is mostly from the Palestinian territory. Is that right?
Not so sure, because Mount Hermon is really the major water supply. Well, one of the major freshwater supplies. Mount Hermon is in Lebanon, Syria, and Israel. Mm-hmm. And so the water circulates into other regions along with Israel. That would be the Upper Jordan feeding the Sea of Galilee and then the Lower Jordan. And out of that, Israel diverts a whole lot of water for the southern regions through the water carrier. So that's one of the major sources for Israel. But you're right in knowing that one of the major aquifers, the Western Aquifer, is pretty much completely under the West Bank. And yet Israel controls something like, or uses something like 85%. They control all of it. And right. They allot 15% to the Palestinians. But one side story that I don't know if anybody has brought up yet is the general water condition there. It's a very arid region, as most people know. But for the last 10 years, it's been in drought. Except last winter, there was a lot of rain. And when I was there in the spring, people were just very happy about all the water that had fallen during the rainy season. Whether that was enough to recover from the drought, I'm not sure. But what that means is there's a lot of pressure on all the parties there to solve the water situation. That means desalination. That means conservation. That means perhaps piping in water from Turkey. That's been proposed. And so this might be an incentive. The drought might be an incentive for Palestine and Israel to coordinate.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Skip. I appreciate your taking the time and I want to thank you for the work that you do in the West Bank in Gaza, and I don't know anyone who goes over more than you do. Okay. Thanks very much.
It's a treat to be interviewed by John Roberts himself.
Thank you. Take care.
The Thirsting for Justice campaign just wrapped up. To read about it further, just Google the website of the Middle East Children's Alliance, Mecca, and you will see how we did, trying to live on 24 quarts of water a day, the amount that many Palestinians must live on every day. September 16th marked 30 years since Christian Lebanese militiamen, allied to Israel, entered the Palestinian refugee camp of Shatila in the adjacent neighborhood of Sabra in Beirut under the watch of the Israeli army and began a slaughter that caused outrage around the world. Over the next day and a half, up to 3,500 Palestinian and Lebanese civilians, mostly women, children, and the elderly, were murdered in one of the worst atrocities in modern Middle East history. On the 30th anniversary, the New York Times published an op-ed containing new details of discussions held between Israeli and American officials before and during the massacre. They revealed how Israeli officials, led by then-Defense Minister Ariel Sharon, misled and bullied American diplomats, rebuffing their concerns about the safety of the inhabitants of Sabra and Shatila. The Institute for Middle East Understanding offers the following summary. On June 6, 1982, Israel launched a massive invasion of Lebanon. It had been long planned by Israeli Defense Minister Ariel Sharon, who wanted to destroy or severely diminish the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, which was based in Lebanon at that time. Sharon also planned to install a puppet government headed by Israelis' right-wing Lebanese Christian Maronite allies, the Falangist Party. Israeli forces advanced all the way to the capital of Beirut, besieging and bombarding the western part of the city where the PLO was headquartered and the Palestinian refugee camp of Shatila and the adjacent neighborhood of Sabra are located. Israel's bloody week-long assault on West Beirut in August prompted harsh international criticism, including from the administration of U.S. President Ronald Reagan, who many accused of giving a green light to Israel to launch the invasion. Under a U.S.-brokered ceasefire agreement, PLO leaders and more than 14,000 fighters were to be evacuated from the country, with the U.S. providing written assurances for the safety of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian civilians left behind. U.S. Marines were deployed as part of a multinational force to oversee and provide security for the evacuation. On August 30th, PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat left Beirut along with the remainder of the Palestinian fighters based in that city. On September 10th, the U.S. Marines left Beirut. 4 days later, on September 14th, the leader of Israel's Falangist allies, Bashir Gemayel, was assassinated. Gemayel had just been elected president of Lebanon by the Lebanese parliament under the supervision of the occupying Israeli army. His death was a severe blow to Israel's designs for the country. The following day, Israeli forces violated the ceasefire agreement, moving into the occupying West Bank. On Wednesday, September 15th, the Israeli army surrounded the Palestinian refugee camp of Shatila and the adjacent neighborhood of Sabra in West Beirut. The next day, September 16th, Israeli soldiers allowed about 150 Falangist militiamen into Sabra and Shatila. The Falange, known for their brutality and a history of atrocities against Palestinian civilians, were bitter enemies of the PLO and its leftist and Muslim Lebanese allies during the preceding years of Lebanon's civil war. The enraged Falangist militiamen believed, erroneously, that Falange leader Gemayel had been assassinated by Palestinians. He was actually killed by a Syrian agent. Over the next day and a half, the Falangists committed unspeakable atrocities, raping, mutilating, and murdering as many as 3,500 Palestinian and Lebanese civilians, most of them children, women, and the elderly. Sharon would later claim that he could have had no way of knowing that the Falange would harm civilians. However, when U.S. diplomats demanded to know why Israel had broken the ceasefire and entered West Beirut, Israeli Army Chief of Staff Rafael Eitan justified the move, saying it was, quote, to prevent a Falangist frenzy of revenge, unquote. On September 15th, the day before the massacre began, Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin told U.S. Envoy Morris Draper that the Israelis had to occupy West Beirut, quote, otherwise there would be pogroms, unquote. Almost immediately after the killing started, Israeli soldiers surrounding Sabra and Shatila became aware that civilians were being murdered, but did nothing to stop it. Instead, Israeli forces fired flares into the night to illuminate the darkness for the Falangists, allowing reinforcements to enter the area on the second day of the massacre, and provided bulldozers that were used to dispose of the bodies of many of the victims. On the second day, Friday, September 17th, an Israeli journalist in Lebanon called Defense Minister Sharon to inform him of reports that a massacre was taking place in Sabra and Shatila. The journalist later recalled, quote, I found Sharon at home sleeping. He woke up and I told him, listen, there are stories about killings and massacres in the camps. A lot of our officers know about it and tell me about it. And if they know about it, then the whole world will know about it. You can stop it. I didn't know that the massacre actually started 24 hours earlier. I thought it had started only then, and I said to him, quote, look, we still have time to stop it. Do something about it. He didn't react. On Saturday, American envoy Morris Draper sent a furious message to Sharon stating, you must stop the massacres. They are obscene. I have an officer in the camp counting the bodies. You ought to be ashamed. The situation is rotten and terrible. They're killing children. You are in absolute control of the area and therefore responsible for the area. The Falangists finally left the area at about 8 o'clock Saturday morning, taking many of the surviving men with them for interrogation at a soccer stadium. The interrogations were carried out with Israeli intelligence agents, who handed many of the captives back to the Falange. Some of the men returned to the Falange were later found executed. About an hour after the Falangists departed Sabra and Shatila, the first journalist arrived on the scene, and the first reports of what transpired began to reach the outside world. In 2004, we had the opportunity to visit Shatila refugee camp in Beirut and met with some of the survivors of the 1982 massacre. It was a chilling experience to be in that camp and hear the firsthand reports of the cold-blooded execution of thousands of helpless women, children, and elderly, residents trapped in the camp. Shatila is a dense prison of a camp. Its alleys are so narrow that in some of them, coffins have to be carried on their side to get through the narrow confines of the camp. There is no open space for children to play. The only growth space to accommodate an expanding population is up. On the edge of the camp is an open area the size of a baseball field, under which thousands of bodies, mostly unidentified, were hastily buried in a mass grave following the massacre. The neighborhoods of Sabra was mostly rubble of homes, which was totally destroyed in the blood blast. The neighborhood virtually eliminated. It has been 30 years, but we cannot forget what happened to Shatila and Sabra. We should continue to hold Israel and Ariel Sharon responsible for what happened there in September of 1982. Palestinian refugees were betrayed by those who had promised to protect them if the PLO left Beirut. The PLO did leave Beirut, but Israel and the United States did not hold up their end of the bargain. They allowed the massacre of thousands of defenseless Palestinians, and they should be held accountable for that betrayal. To date, they have not. Well, that is all the time we have for this week in Palestine. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next week on Truth and Justice Radio. Until then, this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning from the studios of WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. Good morning.